The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, December 28th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Ladies and gentlemen, is one of our famous end of the year, last week of the year, best of shows. Those shows where I say to myself, I hope we don't leave this year without people listening to this show at least once. I hope they listen to it twice. So you know what? We're going to play it again. And then I say to myself, and it would be nice if Matt pulled some best of the fun half. And then I realize, like, oh God, it's been so many days that have passed since I said that to myself. I should communicate this to Matt so that he knows to do it and gets it done. And then we have a little bit of argument. And, you know, I throw PSP credits at him. He just takes that in PlayStation and he just goes and he gets download credits to upload his.
Which is especially tough for me because I play Xbox.
Damn it. That's why it never works. Should have got you those Xbox credits. Then he can go and he can get more, you know, he gets more, what do you get? Like more energy for your power pack or whatever it is.
Bill Gates juice.
You get Bill Gates juice. I mean, do you get to like, you get like a cheat code and you can move up into level 5 of whatever game you're playing?
Yeah, level 5 is the best.
Level 5 is the best. It's great. Ladies and gentlemen, on today's program, we have a guest and a lot of people would be like, oh, hey, Sam, would you really play this if things hadn't gone with the way that with MSNBC? And I say, yeah, no, of course. That's a little hint as to who the guest is. But before we actually get to that description, let me just remind you that I've returned probably from Michigan by now. And I know what you're thinking. Sam, did you freak out when you were in Michigan? Did you freak out because you couldn't keep up your almost obsessive compulsive desire to maintain the level of your dental hygiene? And here it is. The answer is no. The answer is no. I didn't freak out. Why? Because I maintained my almost obsessive level of dental hygiene. How did I do that? I brought my Quip. It is a great... Now, look, Christmas is past, right? But it's never a bad time to buy somebody a gift. Maybe they were depressed. They didn't get the gift they wanted to get. Or maybe you realize, like, I should have gotten that person a gift. Let me tell you something. The value of giving someone a gift in the first week of January is so much greater than giving it at Christmas. Because people are like, wow. Everybody gives a gift at Christmas. You just gave me a gift in January.
It's like dessert.
It's like dessert, except for better for your teeth. That's the point, Matt. Yeah. And with Quip, you don't have to worry about getting a new brush head or toothpaste. They're delivered right to your door on schedule, so you replace your brush on time. You have better oral hygiene at an affordable price with the sleekest design you've ever seen for an electric toothbrush. Two reasons why people don't maintain brushing with an electric toothbrush, in my experience. One is the device is just too big. You leave it on your countertop, you're like, oh, God, I got to pull this and this and that. I feel like I'm a dock worker. I got to bring the crane over. I got to do this. Quip is basically the size of your normal toothbrush.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to tell if you didn't know.
No, and it's in fact sleeker than some of the other, like, you know, toothbrush that you spend money on. But here's the bottom line, folks. Yes, they send you toothpaste. Toothpaste is great. It makes your breath fresh. The key to dental hygiene is the motion of the brush. And with Quip, you barely have to do anything. The brush does the work. You do it very lightly because you want to protect the gums, and it vibrates. And it's fantastic. It gives you even like a timing situation. Quip's subscription model is the other reason why. Because what happens is, oh, I didn't update, I don't get a new brush head, or it's too inconvenient for me to brush. No, all of that is done for you. It is like basically idiot-proofed. The subscription model, it's a thoughtful, inexpensive solution for people who want to make it easy to keep up with the simple habits that will improve their oral health. Let Quip do the thinking for you when it comes to your teeth. It's going to be love at first brush. Trust me. No charger, no wires. It's compact, it's light. Makes brushing twice daily, easily at home or on the road. That's my point. I brought that thing to Michigan. I couldn't do it with my old clunky electric toothbrush. Couldn't do it. Quip starts at just $25 right now when you go to getquip.com/majority to get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip, getquip.com/majority. Spelled getquip.com/majority. So, folks, here's the deal. One of my favorite writers of all time ended up getting a TV show and then, didn't have him on as much because he's too busy. But he wrote a book, his second book. The first one was Twilight's of the Elite. That book was probably like 5 years too early. Saw this, everything coming down the pike.
It's almost scary.
Then he wrote A Colony in a Nation, which I think is one of the more thoughtful assessments of policing relative to our society, and particularly how it deals with the difference between the experience of police as between the way that the police relate to the African-American and essentially white communities in this country. I mean, more or less. I'm painting with a broad brush here. He does not. So Chris Hayes, of course, is the host of All In with Chris Hayes. His book, A Colony in a Nation. Fascinating a book. I recommend you go get it and read it. But first, listen to this interview, and then also enjoy the best of Matt picks of the fun half of 2017. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the New York Times bestselling author for now two different books and author of his most recent, A Colony in a Nation, Chris Hayes. Hello, Chris. Welcome back.
Sam, it's great to be here. You know, this week I was knocked down a peg by the debut of the Bill O'Reilly new book. He's got two. The new one is about traditional values against snowflakes. I just thought, like, that's so perfect. He published that book this week. Make the subtext text about what this all means. Perfect.
What is his, does he have a subtitle on that? Is it something like my life?
Old school, I think.
Yeah, I bet.
Exactly. It's like it might as well be called like Good Old Boys or like, you know,
My Life as a Madman. Yeah, that's pretty funny. Well, I'm sorry to hear that O'Reilly has knocked you out of the pole position there. But I've told you this before. I really enjoyed this book, and congratulations on its well-deserved success. But let's start with the title, because yeah. It came from, was it research you were doing on the book? Or, I mean, was it something that you had
I'd started to do research. Basically, I got an email from Tom Mayer, who's my editor at Norton, who'd written to my agent while watching me cover Baltimore, saying like, oh, has Chris ever thought about writing about this stuff in a book form? And I was kind of like, I don't think so. I'm not sure. It's not really my story to tell, and I'm not sure what I can contribute. But I started sort of thinking about what I would do if I wrote about it. And I was, I thought, well, I should go back. I was really obsessed with the concept of Law and Order because to me, I feel like in Ferguson, particularly, I'd sort of had this realization of how important the order part of that formulation is. And so I was like, oh, I should go back to sort of the original text of Law and Order, which is Nixon, and particularly Nixon's 68 campaign. And I was reading the convention speech that he gave in Miami Beach, where he has this line. It's sort of a throwaway line where he says, you know, black citizens, they want the same as white citizens. They don't want to be a colony in a nation. And that phrase just bowled me over because, first of all, it's basically what we constructed. But second of all, the other sort of theme that had been recurring through my head was just the degree to which police in the environments I was in and the interviews I was doing felt like occupying forces, felt like soldiers from a foreign army. And that phrase kind of catalyzed that in a way, and it sent me on this sort of interesting spiral back into our own colonial history and things like that.
And the irony is, though, is that Nixon was not talking about law and order at all, right? He was talking about sort of like welfare, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He was making a kind of, remember that Paul Ryan about like, we don't want this
the hammock, to
turn
right?
into a hammock, right? That was like, it was his own version of that like, you know, basically that African Americans want, you know, they want an independent access to industry and wealth and on the great American dream. And they don't want to just be a colony. They don't want to be like sort of sitting there getting state aid. But, you know, it's Nixon that sort of pioneers the kind of rhetoric and policy that is what begins the process of constructing this massive machinery of policing and jails and prisons and incarceration.
Well, I mean, I want to circle back to that question. But if this really is a construct from Nixon, or if it's really just part of a continuum, frankly. But before we get there, let's talk about how you use that phrase from Nixon, because you do sort of. I mean, and maybe I think you've just touched on it a little bit, but you specifically, which I also, I mean, I found really, and maybe the most fascinating part was those direct parallels that you make to America as a colony and the relationship between, you know, that analogy between the way what you saw in a place like Ferguson or in Baltimore and what America was in the 1760s and 70s or so. I mean, lay that out for us a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, what the sort of central thing I think to recognize that I didn't realize is that when we think about the revolution being about taxation and representation, that taxation is sort of a little bit misleading because we think of taxation, we think about our own tax system, right? Which is like, you know, you file your forms or your payroll taxes and all this stuff. And none of that existed right at the time. All taxation was collected through customs enforcement, because that's how you tax stuff back then. That's how empires operated. They controlled their colonies and they sort of taxed all the trade through tariffs, and customs enforcers were the ones who enforced that. And because of these strict customs laws, the colonies were just a hotbed of smuggling. In fact, not just like smuggling as a kind of ancillary activity, but actually as the main economic activity. The distilleries that produce rum in the colonies, which was the sort of one of the central businesses of the colonies, ran on molasses that couldn't be imported from British Islands, were imported from Dutch Islands, and were all smuggled in. And, you know, John Hancock was one of the biggest smugglers. So smugglers had tremendous social capital, lots of money. They were these central figures. And what happens is after the England spends a lot of money in a 7 years war with the French, in the French Indian War, the new crown decides they're going to close the budget deficit by ratcheting up customs enforcement. And they crack down, and the crackdown is a, you know, it's a set of police actions. I mean, I call it the first stop and frisk era. You've got these general writs of assistance that mean customs officials can search anyone anywhere. They can break into your house. They can look into your possessions. They can pull over any boat. You've got Benjamin Franklin writing about how insane it is to use the Navy, which starts getting dragged into this enforcement action, to essentially militarize your police, to use the Navy to be, you know, dragging people. You've got John Adams talking about a central case in which a lawyer, a prominent lawyer, fights against these writs of assistance, and Adams comes away saying, everyone in that room came away with the spirit of revolution. Then and there, the spark of revolution was lit. And you've even got Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence itself, in a line I just didn't realize was there, complaining of the king. In the list of complaints, he has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. I mean, you know, that's Jeffersonese for fuck the police.
Right. And so, I mean, how does that, at one point you almost compare and contrast John Hancock with Garner, with Eric Garner in selling sort of the illicit cigarettes, but it's obviously their stature is very different. But that notion of the, I mean, now bring that back forward in time.
Yeah, like the you know, one way to think about the one way to think about the smuggling regime is to think about the drug war, right? So the state decrees some set of goods, you know, prohibited, and those goods still, there's still demand for them. They still enjoy a certain amount of, you know, that they're not totally socially taboo, right? People use them, and they have an economic black market that gets, you know, created around them. So in some ways, you can compare the smugglers to drug dealers. But, you know, Eric Garner wasn't a drug dealer. Eric Garner was just doing something that was almost directly parallel to what the smugglers were doing, which is that he was evading the tariff on cigarettes. I mean, you know, he was selling these Lucy's that were untaxed, and so evading the tariff on this good. And for doing that, he was confronted by the police and ultimately choked and killed. And there's just some horrible, tragic irony that this man, who says in the final monologue before he says, I can't breathe, time and time again, he says, every time you see me, you want to come and harass me. And that's the word. That is exactly the word that Jefferson uses when he talks about the crown. He says, he sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance, make it impossible for them to make a living. And here's Eric Garner selling untaxed cigarettes, confronting the sentries of the state who are going to arrest him for exactly the thing that our founders engaged in and fought a revolution about.
And so, and the other, I guess, use of that, there's not just the analogy in terms of the way that the police, but also the extraction, right? I mean, because the nation to a colony, you colonize basically to get resources, and
right,
that parallel also exists with Ferguson.
It absolutely does. I mean, Ferguson particularly, it's very clear that in the same way that the sort of Crown's policing was done for revenue, that's precisely what happens in Ferguson. In fact, in the DOJ report, where they have access to the emails of all the officials in Ferguson, they're incredibly frank about it. They talk about, like, getting up the new revenue pipeline, or, like, saying to the police chief, like, well, how many dollars do you think you can use to make up this budget deficit we have by basically enforcing, you know, pulling people over? So you've got in Ferguson, rather than raising property taxes or other taxes, a huge percentage of the revenue for the town comes from ticket revenue. And that ticket revenue is, you know, is enforced by the police, who use their policing power to more or less prey upon and extract dollars from the predominantly black and brown passengers who are in cars.
And so, and then the I guess the other element of the colony and a nation is that one where you talk about the idea that this is a that there's almost an occupying force. I mean, that there's not, it's not just, I mean, I guess that maybe ties in with the police stuff, but and also this notion of white fear, which I think you talk about as almost like an inheritance in some way.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that the sort of occupying nature of it is the fact that we have these agents of the state who are there to maintain order in neighborhoods, who by and large in almost every case are not from the neighborhood, right? Sometimes they are, but the sort of institutional memory and culture of the place is out external to it. They tend to view the places as, you know, uncivilized hotbeds of illegality. I mean, you've got in Cleveland, in a vehicle bay, the Department of Justice inspectors who are there see a sign calling that vehicle bay a forward operating base, which is, you know, what the military uses to connote like a small camp deep in enemy territory in Afghanistan. You've got a Baltimore sergeant instructing his police before they go out for patrol to do not treat criminals like citizens, right? Like, the whole point of the Constitution is that everyone gets treated like a citizen. Right. We all have constitutional protection. So you've got this mindset, you know, James Baldwin writes in this essay I quote about the police walking through Harlem like a, you know, a soldier in a foreign land. This mindset of this, you're in this foreign place and it's hostile towards you and you're there to kind of sublimate it and to subjugate it and to order it. And then driving this, driving the whole creation, driving Nixon's rhetoric and Donald Trump's rhetoric and Rudy Giuliani's rhetoric and, you know, countless bits of rhetoric, you know, through the years of this escalation is what I call white fear, which I say is this cultural inheritance that starts the day that the boat settling Jamestown comes ashore and the captain writes the first entry in his diary, like, we were set upon by the savages. And the experience of settlement, of the frontier, of the slave plantation for the white folks who are winning and conquering, even as they're winning and conquering, is one of this sort of paranoia and fear, right? Fear of the indigenous people, you know, retaking their land, fear of slave rebellion. That idea that there's that the sort of order that the settler colonial folks have managed to impose on what they view as this sort of barbarous new world, that order is contingent and might be claimed back, taken back by the dark forces, and I use that term advisedly, you know, outside the clearing. Like, that to me is like, that is central to our sort of inheritance as a nation.
I mean, is the fear just the flip side of the coin of like of the extraction? I mean, on some level, right? Like,
right, they're going to take it back. You mean?
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's not, well, we're taking something, so it's obviously like, we, you know, and whether that was we're taking free labor, we're taking, you know, we're taking the reduced labor. I mean, we're taking huge economic benefit. I mean, the country was completely built upon this. And, you know, there's always a backlash. I mean, so like the fear is not it's not necessarily, it's maybe organic's the wrong word, but it is, the fear is sort of a second order issue, right? It's like,
yes, right. No, right. I mean, I sort of say that in the book, right? Like, it's almost morally perverse to talk about like the fear of the slaver. Like,
right,
like
exactly.
That's not the fear we care about, you know, like he's doing horrible things and the fear of, you know, the incomprehensible terror of being a slave. So it's not at all the morally salient attribute, and it's not even the most salient attribute in some ways to the exchange, right? I mean, like the slave owner is extracting huge amounts of value. I think is also in some cases I think is sort of being transformed by the sadism and cruelty of the enterprise, but I think that as a descriptive matter of how we structure our thinking about particularly crime in this realm, it is just inescapably, its kernel is in that sort of passed down experience of white fear.
I mean, on some level, right? It's a continuum. I mean, I guess I've just become more conscious of that continuum. I mean, there, you know, whether it's like Michelle Alexander, or I think it was Carol Anderson who wrote that book, White Rage, and where there is this almost rhythmic quality to American history, where when there's any measure of emancipation, there is almost, I don't know if it's, you know, how you calculate this, two steps forward, one and a half steps back, one step back, half step back. But on some level, this is, I mean, is this dynamic a function of, is the carceral state that we see that you are in some ways describing, right? Both in terms of like small C and broader C, bigger C, I guess. Is that how distinct
how new
is it? How new is it, and how distinct is it from, you know, is it a problem with policing or is it a problem with society that says we need the police to do this and we can't really quite admit that we need the police to do this.
Well, to answer the second question first, I mean, part of the argument in the book is it is a problem with society that, like, the police are agents of a lot of democratic decisions that have been made by us collectively as a people, as voters, particularly as a white majority in lots of places, and that's the place to look. So that I would say yes, like, there's problems with policing qua policing from a sort of institutional and professional cultural standpoint, but there's a broader problem of what we've tasked them to do. The second question is a really important and interesting one, and one that I try to wrestle with a bit in the book, and I've been talking a lot in these book talks, which is there's sort of two things to keep in mind, right? There's the continuity you're talking about, which is, you know, it's crazy. You can go back and read accounts of police brutality in Harlem in 1919 and a riot that precipitated it, you know, the death of a young boy at the hands of police, and it's like nothing's changed. Right. Like, it's unbelievable. Or you can read about the ways in which, you know, essentially slave patrols become law enforcement in the South. And so there is this just tremendous continuity. But there's also something distinct that it's important to kind of highlight, which is, like, the prison population of the country, the sort of magnitude of arrests, the construction of the world's largest criminal justice system, that's distinct and new starting around 1968. And going to now. I mean, you know, for all that continuity in the sort of subtext, the cultural impulses, the politics, the kind of white fear, like, the actual system is new in the sense of that it's distinct. We don't have, you know, one-fourth of the world's prisoners in 1950, and we do by 2011, right? So we do construct this huge thing. The number of arrests go up, the number of prosecutions, the number of people in jail, the number of people in prisons, the number of, mandatory minimums and drug laws and enforcement dollars and seizure of, you know, forfeiture and SWAT teams and no-knock raids, and all of these things are a distinct phenomenon that sort of starts in the late 60s and extends through today.
And to what extent can you, I mean, what's the relationship between, in the event that we could dismantle, I mean, you know, just the past two or three days have two things in the news that sticks out for me that are, you know, sort of directly impact what you're talking about in your book. Obviously, Jeff Sessions basically saying, like, you know, to police forces around the country, don't worry. You know, shackles are off now. You guys go back doing whatever you do. In fact, we're giving you a future pass, which I can only imagine where that's going to lead. And then, obviously, the reversal on private prisons and, you know, everything has dramatically changed on that playing field, it seems to me. And the hopes we may have had for sort of conservatives and, you know, a transpartisan, trans-ideological criminal right. reform movement, I think, is sort of by the wayside. Also, though, in Ferguson, they just reelected its white Republican mayor for a third term.
Yeah.
By 15 points. Yeah. points. And there does not, I mean, so let me ask you this. I mean, if
what's that about?
Right. Well, like, what's what that about? That? What is, I mean, what
well,
do you
here's,
do?
Here's, let me say this about, I don't know. I have not been doing enough reporting in Ferguson recently to give a good insight into that. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't want to, I haven't done the legwork to talk to voters there and give some explanation of what happened there. But I will say this, like, and I've been saying this on book tour, you know, we obviously are very focused on, you know, Sessions can do tremendous damage if he, you know, nullifies these consent decrees, if they don't do patterns and practices, if they don't provide oversight, he could do tremendous damages the way police departments operate. And the president can do a lot of bad things too. But one of the most important things to recognize is how locally this system was built. I mean, it really was, you know, there's thousands of different municipalities and interlocking jurisdictions. There's local elected prosecutors and city council mayors and council members and mayors of towns like James Knowles and state reps and state legislatures. And there's so many different entities that sort of constructed this system. And in some ways, that's hopeful for the following reason, that a lot of these people get elected in extremely low turnout elections. that if you are mobilized and committed to changing, you can. And we've seen some interesting organizing happening around prosecutor elections. There's one in Cook County. There was one in Orlando. Right now, Philadelphia is electing their prosecutor in a really interesting race. And in all those cases, like, if you're someone who's like, this matters to me, and you put in time and money and you volunteer and you organize, like, you can have a really huge impact leverage-wise just because those races are so, you know, they're so poorly poorly paid attention to.
True. I guess my concern on some level is that people's awareness of that problem and ability to organize it are obviously diminished if there is no federal sort of, I guess, threat, essentially, right? On some level. And on another, I mean, I guess, you know, obviously I can't speak to Ferguson, but, you know, you got a 67% black population there. And presumably there are a lot of activists in that community.
It goes to show, I mean, it is a, what fires people up, what gets them to pay attention. I mean, that is a broader sort of alchemical equation that I'm, you know, you and I have actually talked about this because right. I mean, both of us are in positions to sort of really see in this weird way, right? These metrics of what is sort of getting people fired up.
It's hard to get people interested in this and motivated on some level.
Yeah.
And also, I think there's also probably huge swaths of people. I mean, again, I don't want to make presumptions about what's going on in Ferguson, but I imagine there's a lot of people who are feeling, and maybe we saw some of that in this past presidential election, that, like, you know what? Doesn't really make a difference. It doesn't.
Right.
It just, this stuff is bigger than government. But in reality, I mean, in many respects, it is, but government starts to chip away at this, right? I mean, if by some way we could magically change the penal system in this country, it would, without any change in the sort of white supremacy, I guess, that undergirds a lot of this, right? I mean, because if we were, as white people, really upset about our police doing this stuff, we would have already acted upon it, right? Because, you know, none of this stuff would be tolerated. I mean, you write in the book, where you live in Brooklyn, none of this stuff would be tolerated there. None of it.
No. And certainly not. I mean, the other thought experiment I have in the book is, like, if you took this policing method to, like, any elite campus, like, people would lose their minds, right? Like, if, like, you know, like, I mean, what percentage of people walking around, like, a campus are carrying drugs at any moment? Like, a non-insignificant.
If there was stop and frisk on the campus.
If they just stop and frisk and were like,
of Brown
on
University,
the main green at,
I think
yeah,
there would
at Brown.
There'd be a lot of, like, phone calls that would come in from
more than
parents,
phone calls,
but,
dude.
Yeah, exactly.
They would, like, I mean, it would be, yeah, it would just be, you know, so. Yeah, I mean, I guess you're sort of asking this hard question about, like, how you change the sort of deep structure of, like, sort of these white fear and pathology. You know, part of writing the book to me was just trying to get people to recognize when it's happening in them, when they're being appealed to in these terms. And I think it's really important to recognize how broad that appeal is. Like, the appeal, you know, it's not just like the, you know, Trump voters in West Virginia. It's like, you know, white liberals elected Rudy Giuliani the mayor of New York based on these same appeals. There's big parts of us that are receptive to it. We're conditioned to be receptive to it. And in some ways, I think sort of the first step is just recognizing when those receptors are being engaged.
Do you think it's, I mean, those receptors, do you think it's just fear? I mean, or do you think it's, I mean, because you touch on the idea, and I should say that, I mean, I think, you know, you start the book out with sort of, you know, your a personal experience, you end on one, on that sort of, and throughout you drop in those moments, like when you're at the, was it the RNC, I think, was apparently trying to smuggle drugs into the RNC. You've written, not necessarily consciously, maybe I'm mischaracterizing.
Haplessly attempting to smuggle drugs in the RNC.
But it was, turned out to be no issue, maybe a little embarrassing, and of course, you know, that is just ghastly different from the experience of of you know, a 16-year-old black kid living in the Bronx, you know,
right, or Dave Unlove, who lives in West Baltimore, who I talk about sort of having a kind of mirror experience in which he almost gets, you know, busted for a robbery he did not commit, you know, and only through sort of like being sort of quick on his feet enough does he manage to evade what could have been just a disastrous turn in his life.
But there's also this element of, like, you know, that it's tied into this idea of, you know, in the nation element of it, like where we live in a place where there are good schools and there are good amenities and we want to live in a good neighborhood. And there's it's not just out of fear, right? I mean, there's
that's right. I mean, part of it is we want, you know, we have sort of, what we've done is we've sort of overlaid these different things such that, like, a good school and a good neighborhood mean these very specifically, like, racially loaded things, in a way that they don't have to, right? So, like, the desire to, like, send your kid to a good school is a, you know, a genuine and universally held desire that, because of the way that we've chosen to structure society, means like sending them to a predominantly white school, right?
Right.
Like, and I think that part of the broader lesson here, and this is something I've really come to believe firmly, the broader lesson to me is just that it has a lot to do with what happens in the late 1960s on civil rights and civil rights enforcement, right? You get the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing Act. And you have school systems going through this very torturous process of desegregating, finding different ways of desegregating, and being fought at every turn. And there's this sort of, you know, you're from Worcester, so this, I'm sure, is sort of present in your cultural memory. There's the kind of like Waterloo of it all with the Boston busing fight.
Mm-hmm.
And what basically happens, you know, post the 1970s particularly, is just as a society, we just give up on desegregation as an overarching policy goal. In 2017, if you say, like, I am running on a platform of desegregation, people will be like, you're crazy. What are you talking about? But that project was never completed at all.
No, in fact, it's gone. It's gone worse, I think.
Yeah, it's gotten worse. And it's just like we had this project called desegregation in which, and it was a brutal fight at every square inch, you know, fought against. And eventually, like, the forces that were fighting it kind of won. I mean, and they won in all sorts of ways. I mean, the Supreme Court, you know, through a series of cases, particularly Parents Involved, which is a monstrous case, you know, basically makes it impossible to desegregate schools. There's, you know, the enforcement, the sort of, and then, you know, there's an inertial quality to it, which is that once places, the sort of, once lines get drawn, and school districts are school districts, then it's like everyone is just in their place. And like, we've allowed all those borders and lines to harden. And we don't have anyone really at any level, like, talking about that as unacceptable and something that we should undo.
I mean, it seems to me like that soft segregation, right, that we do now, right? It's not institutionally imposed, and right. but we've just organized things in a way to sort of take care of itself in some ways,
right,
is like analogous to that, this dynamic of a colony nation, that is maybe they're basically very similar structures, if not the same structure. It's just on one end of that is the tip of the spear being the, I guess, you know, the policing. And the other end of that is just sort of like a general sorting, right? Like there's this metaphorical, you know, ocean that we're the nation, and then, you know, we send ships to the colony.
Right, that's right, and that's exactly right. And in some ways, like it's the distance of the inner life we've allowed to grow up between these sort of two regimes that also makes confronting it difficult, right? Because like it's sort of this out of sight, out of mind situation, and that's particularly true of New York circa 2017, in a way it wasn't of New York circa 1997,
right?
When because of the much higher crime rate and because of the way the city sort of imposed itself on you, it was harder to just sort of like retreat into like a little like placid, placid little corner of the nation. Right. But that's, you know, that's what we've constructed. And I mean, obviously this connects to other broader themes in, you know, the work I've done. And in my first book of like, it's just another way in which like the sort of trajectory of American life is towards this sort of like balkanization, particularly along kind of race and class lines, where it's like there are these, you know, these small precincts that are, you know, it looks like a society that's not a middle class society. I mean that's the shortest way to say it, but you know, places of sort of protection, privilege, stability, thriving, and then, you know, huge places of the, you know, struggle.
Let me ask you a meta question, because I, you know, Twilights of the Elite was very, I don't know, prescient or just, you know, sort of aware of what was going on at that time, right? I mean, we have really, we've reached it. I wonder if when you were writing this book, I mean, did you, you know, contextually, I assume that you were assuming Clinton was going to win, and these type of questions, I mean, obviously the book has done quite well, but these type of questions would, I think, under a Clinton administration, have attained a much higher status or much more...
They would be much more central in the, like, national domestic political agenda.
Yeah, indeed, right? Because right? Exactly. And, I mean,
yeah,
how much...
Yeah, because they would be, you know, there would be legislative movement on some, you know, criminal justice and policing reform. That would be a thing that, you know, it's something she ran on and something that, you know, they would be working on, I think.
And there would, and there would be a lot of people, I mean, I think, like, particularly the campaign would set up, you know, and you know, the BLM folks, and just there was a lot of the dynamic would have thrown these questions into a more central, I think, equation. So, like, just tell me your thoughts on that, you know, because you write this book, and I don't imagine when you wrote Twilight of the Elites that you anticipated, like, you know, because it was not the topics in that book were not as sort of like who was president was not as much of an issue, right? I mean, it's I think on some level.
Yeah. Although I think, you know, in one way, I think that that's true from the domestic political agenda. But I think that, like, to me, the book is sort of more resonant now as a sort of
what's going on in the world.
Well, what's going on in the world and the sort of mapping of the mind of sort of Trump's appeal, right?
Right. I mean, yes.
You know, I mean, my, you know, I've come to realize that, like, part of what made Trump, you know, Trump's entire worldview is formed by being in New York in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And it's a worldview of, that combines two things. One is, like, the experience of social crisis unraveling, material decline. Things are getting worse. Things are going to hell in a handbasket. And that it's being done at the hands of some, you know, other.
Right. Just watch Warriors, right? It's Warriors, right?
Yeah, I mean, you remember? It is Warriors. I think his worldview, which is very much like, that's his worldview. That is like authentic. Like, I don't think there's always this question of like, how much is he demagoguing and playing to his crowd and how much is he, but that part of the worldview is authentic. And even though I thought of that experience of New York during those years as distinct, it turns out that those elemental experiences, decline plus blame for said decline on some other, is endlessly exportable to all sorts of corners of the country.
Indeed. Oh, of course.
You know, from Mahoning County to Erie County to McDowell County, West Virginia. Like, and nowhere is this more present to me than in the border rhetoric, because the border is his version of broken windows. Like, the idea of broken windows is like this, like, neurotic sense that, like, there's disorder and unraveling and it needs to be, like, staunched, right? And when you think about the border, it's like, why does the border wall have such outsized, you know, symbolic potency in the Trump canon? Particularly when you think, like, why does anyone in West Virginia care about the border?
Right.
What, like, literally, what's it to you? they're not coming to, you know, coming to you. Like, and if they do, like, you know, the people are going to come maybe get a job somewhere. But the reason is because the border represents, you know, almost in like an overly literal way, right? Like, it represents that lack of order. It represents the sort of like incursion and the source of white fear and all the sort of stuff I talk about in the book, that kind of sense of contingency. They're going to take that land back. They're going to take it back. And the potency of that, I mean, nothing illustrates the potency, the continued potency, and the almost like endlessly universal potency of it than his election.
And really, I mean, the two different types of policing that you talk about in the colony and the nation, right? I mean, it was perfectly mirrored almost in the campaign on some level, where he's talking about, you know, policing as maintaining order, and as opposed to the concept in the nation, which is like serve and protect.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right.
All right. Listen, I have you. I got to ask you just a couple of questions about the news. And I know people are
going to
go.
Is there anything going on? I'm just looking at my phone. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Looks like some things happened.
I got one thing that I keep wondering why nobody brings up, where there's no speculation. I want to know if you've heard anything about this. And obviously, like, you know. With Nunes, why has the focus been exclusively on, okay, the idea that the idea that they were trying to whitewash this intel to bring it back to Trump, you know,
right,
to make this case that he had been wiretapped. Why does the fact that the timing of him going to the White House, literally hours after the first time he's been briefed by Comey in private as to what the status of the investigation is and who they might be following and whatnot, why has not the most obvious explanation come up that Nunes was going to tell Trump what they got?
Right. I don't know. That's a great point. I'm glad you connected that dot.
I mean, so I understand. It was the most obvious thing in the world. And Nunes must have...
The timeline is Comey gives him a classified briefing.
For the first time, right? The public briefing was the first time. Prior to that, we had just seen that he wouldn't acknowledge the existence of this investigation to any of the congressional leaders,
right,
until Sessions is recused. Then he goes and he gives a public testimony. Then he gives private testimony. And then Nunes.
Right.
I mean, there's a reason why he's not sharing this stuff, because maybe it exists, but Nunes knows he can't get to the White House. Like, how else would he get word to the White House about exactly what he heard in there?
Right.
I don't know. Maybe this is just sort of off the wall. But, I mean, it seems to me the most obvious thing. That's the most value that Nunes has to those people. Not that he can be, because they could have leaked this stuff to anybody.
Right. Right. Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a great point. I mean, I find myself, like, Nunes is a character who's a little like Carter Page, where it's like, I don't know what to make of them. Like, I'm having a hard time mentally modeling their motivations.
Well, that's the thing, I feel like Nunes was making it all up after the fact.
Bumbling. Like, so bumbling. And so, it's just like, how did this guy get into this position? I just, every time I see him, I'm just like, how did you end up here?
Well, isn't that really the whole story about all of it? I mean, at this point, like, you know, the healthcare debacle. I mean, it was, you know, how did Paul Ryan, like, all of these people are just, it's empty suits. I mean, Mitch McConnell seems to be the only one who knows what he's doing in the entire
thing. Oh yeah, McConnell's many things, but what he is not is an empty suit. Like McConnell 100% knows what he's doing.
I'm just, there are moments like that where I think it's just sort of stunning. I mean, give me your sense of the relative import to the idea of Russian interference versus the relationship that Trump and the Trump organization pre and post election had with malefactors. I mean, I guess,
I don't know. Like, I just feel like I really want to get to the bottom of it. I don't have some sort of theory underneath it. Like, I there are people I know who do, right? There are people I know who are working on a sort of theoretical architecture they've constructed around the facts we know that make predictions about things we will learn. Like a kind of theory of the case. I don't have a theory of the case. And a part of me just thinks like so much of this was so obvious and in public, I'm not clear why you would even need collusion, because like the Russians break in to the DNC. It clearly, people forget that hack, how, important it was. Like, I was in Philadelphia when like the Bernie folks were like screamingly booing the entire first day, any mention of Hillary Clinton. And that was because the day before had been the release of the emails.
Right.
And keep in mind, like, there were like actual, like, Debbie Wasserman Schultz had to go fly home and not be the chair of the DNC. Now, she was in trouble for a million reasons before those emails, but those emails, Donna Brazile, replaced her and then lost her position as a CNN commentator. Like, those had real effects. Then, it becomes pretty clear early on the Russians did that, right?
Now, so, how do we know that, though? I mean, do we know that just because we've been told? I mean, like, when we say Russians, I mean, because I'm just convinced it's just like just some guy, there's a fluidity as to who all these people are.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
That's true. And also, I mean,
Felix Sater, is he a Russian spy? Maybe sometimes.
I have no idea.
Maybe sometimes not.
Like, I don't know what. Yes, exactly. And like you're right. You're right to sort of zero in on like the Russians as like this overly broad category. But I think like state-backed Russian actors. I think that this, particularly the sort of DC leaks and the Guccifer part of it, like it ties it all pretty clearly. And so that happens, and then it's like Trump is like super pro-Putin. Very publicly, right? And then they also help him in October. So it's like that, like all that stuff happens in public with public knowledge. I mean, Donald Trump looks into a camera and tells Russia to hack Hillary Clinton. Like, why would you need some sort of
back
fancy
channel.
Back channel?
Yeah, I think that's just, like, I think there's just like, I think so much of what we see is coincidence. None of which
Can I read you a great headline? This is just crossing over right now. This is the Daily Beast. Steve Bannon calls Jared Kushner a cuck and globalist behind his back.
Oh my God! It's well, all right. So that was the other thing I wanted to talk about. But let me just finish the thought about
Russia.
It's not
an Onion article. I love it.
I mean, is there any doubt that Kushner is a cuck? I mean, come on.
I mean, right.
I mean,
this isn't for all of us to see.
I think there's probably just a lot of coincidence. I'm quite convinced that at the end of this, it's going to be like they're in the White House going like, all we did was pal around with a bunch of Russian mafia guys, did some money laundering, and they accuse us of being spies. Like it's like,
yes, exactly.
It's going to be like one of those things like where you rob a bank, but you end up getting a ticket for speeding. And
absolutely.
Or vice versa.
But I also think like, again, like Lord knows what's in that guy's business dealings and tax return. I mean, so it seems both the spectrum of possibilities from like, yeah, there was no collusion. It was all just like the sort of tacit quid pro quo in public to like, yes, everything in the dossier is real. Like everything in between those seem completely plausible.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
I agree. All right. Well, let me just ask you about that last headline. Are we watching sort of a I mean, I the generals seem to have taken over, right? They take Kushner to Iraq. Then Roger Stone 2 days ago was talking on InfoWars about how Kushner is stabbing Bannon in the back. And then Bannon's right. out from the NSC. I mean, is it McMaster's or is it really Mattis in Iraq basically working on Kushner? And he's, you know, Mattis is like, call your dad. Tell him that Bannon's got to be out. This stuff is serious. We can help out your dad's presidency, but Bannon has got to go.
I mean, what is shaping up in the flurry of leaks, and God, the way this place leaks, is that that you know there's this kind of Bannon Kushner showdown power struggle happening, and I think the generals are probably on Kushner's side, as signaled by that Iraq trip, and also like keep in mind, you know, we reported on my show and it was an exclusive, you know, I got a source saying this, that like, remember the guy before McMaster was Harward.
Right.
And Harward yes. was recruited heavily for the job and basically was like, I need to know that I'm not working for Steve Bannon. I'm like, I can go directly to the President of the United States. And that was the concern that ultimately, like, he could not be assured of that. He didn't take the job. Well, lo and behold, then fast forward, McMaster takes the job. Ms. Master, by the way, who's still active duty, right?
Right. So it's like a little harder for him. Technically say yeah. no, right? Right.
I mean, very hard for him to say no, right? Ms. Master takes a job and wants to get rid of Ezra Cohn Watnick, who is a person Flynn brought into the NSC staff on intelligence. Cohn Watnick goes to, the reporting says, Kushner and Bannon, and then to the president directly to save his job, which he does. Now, he's the guy that's showing Nunes the intel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is just an unbelievable breach, right? To go over the national security advisor's head. I think that showed that like Harward's concerns were exactly right. Now McMaster somehow engineers a kind of revenge, right? Which is that gets Bannon kicked off the principal's committee, gets Coates and Joint Chiefs back on, those two who had been on the sort of standing permanent principal's committee under Obama. And I think is clearly sort of having his revenge on Bannon. And I mean, the spin yesterday was so hilarious. There's a story where
Bannon is talking about, like, I'm ready for a gunfight. Has there ever been a time where, like, people, like major players in the administration are openly talking about hostilities in the White House?
David Zergin said that in the Clinton administration.
Wait, is that yeah. I mean, that seems insane to me, right?
Zergin also went around calling everyone a cuck.
Right. He was famously a cuck caller.
Surrounded by cucks. That was his memoir, actually.
But is Bannon just basically getting ready to exit and, you know, making and just, you know, sort of Breitbartizing this whole thing or what?
I mean, I wonder because God, Lord knows, like both sides are leaking like crazy. I mean, I'm reading this Daily Beast piece here, and like, there's the people that were shivving Bannon with the leaks about how he threatened to leave. I mean, that place is just what a snake pit. It's just unbelievable. I mean,
hopefully the generals will come in and just calm everybody down, and we'll just have this sort of like, this is like a soft military coup. Where they keep Trump.
Well, you worry about that, right? Because yeah. that's clearly like Trump who, I mean, the guy doesn't know anything. He doesn't know anything. And he doesn't, I mean, the other thing is like, the hilarious thing is like, the battle between Bannon and Kushner is a battle of ideology. Kushner, a lifelong Democrat and liberal, Bannon, a nationalist. It's like, right, yeah, like that, like, this was evident from the beginning that the guy doesn't have a belief system. So, like.
Right, that Trump does it. That there's no yes. And I don't. So there, course, I mean, does Kushner?
Of course,
really,
there's going to be a high stakes. There's a high stakes battle for like the vessel.
I mean, do you think Kushner does either? I just get the sense that he and Ivanka are just like, this is, you know, it's cutting down on our social circle a little bit. And you know, Kushner's, there's a picture of Kushner in Iraq wearing his blue blazer with a flak jacket
over it.
And all I'm thinking is like, this guy's now for the first time, surrounded by these military guys who it probably took them like 3 days before Kushner was just like, I'm totally on board with that. You know, like completely just
you guys are amazing.
Overwhelmed. Like I'm going to tell Dad exactly, right? We get rid of Bannon. What else should we do? And that's it. And, you know, I don't know. It gets a little worrisome that you're worrying that the most reasonable guys in the room are the guys probably, at the very least, there's some question about atrocities and they've been
I don't think there's question. It's definitely the case.
That's a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it's really nerve-wracking. I mean, we sat in my office yesterday and we watched him do his press avail with the King of Jordan. By the way, if you had to be like, which one of these is the native speaker of English as the first language between these two? And like, you can just see, you can always see with him, like when he's out past what he knows, which is often.
Right.
You know, the only place where he was like sure-footed was when he's blaming Obama. You know, the Iran deal was terrible. He gets a question about Iranian militias in Syria and Hezbollah, and it's just like nothing. There's no nothing. And it's just like, it was just terrifying to watch. I found my, like, that plummeting quality of the stomach of like, this guy's out there. He has no idea what he's talking about. He's kind of freelancing these answers. You'll see. And, you know, it's a big situation. And it's like, just like the barstool gas bag. But it's like that guy, if he wanted to, could go back into the White House and pick up a phone and be like, we're airstrikes in Syria. He could do that.
Right.
Like, it's terrifying.
The only, I think, upside of him being so obviously out of his depth is that I get the sense that the rest of the world is just like, we don't really have to be too confused about what's going on because the answer is always the guy just doesn't have a clue as to what he's doing.
That is, it's so funny you said that because we were debating this in the office yesterday and like, I think we all came to the conclusion that, right, like, a normal president would be seen as like making policy by things he says.
Right.
But that is not the case here because everyone understands that he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Everyone
just like chalk it up.
It mitigates it that he's internationally known as a total clown. And he's less dangerous because of that, which is amazing. It's like, there are some things that are so bad they're good, and this is worse. And people are just, well. Chris Hayes, I'll let you get back to work. I know you may have some news to talk about tonight.
And you got some stuff that's coming in here on the old smartphone.
There's still a couple hours left in the day, so who knows?
Well, I'm definitely leaving. I mean, Ned Reznikoff, who used to work for me, was a Think Progress Now. It was just like, imagine being a like 63-year-old man who unironically calls people cucks. I mean, who are these people that are running the country? Who are they?
Oh, terrifying.
God. Okay.
A Colony in a Nation. Thanks so much.
The book. Yeah. Go buy some books.
People
all right?
will buy this book. We'll see you later. Thanks, Chris.
All right. All right, see you, man. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. My pilot.
Now, what's really important, folks, is that you see the humanity that exists within the Trump family. It's not just, they're not just a bunch of like syphilitic riddled old men, or they're not just people who want to cut Medicaid by one quarter of its entire budget and throw children and elderly and people living in poverty and people with brain tumors. And it's not just that they want to make your health insurance so crappy that it will again bring half of the bankruptcies back because of a function of medical expenses. They're also people. And what better way to know that they're people than to take a look in their room? Let's let Ivanka show us around her New York City apartment and what's really important to her.
Ivanka recently took us inside her New York apartment for a glimpse of how she lives outside the boardroom. Here are things that she says she can't live without.
Pause it. Wait a second. Is this really from now? This has got to be old. The boardroom? What boardroom? This has got to be old. When would Oprah having Ivanka on now? 3 days ago? What? What boardroom? She's not supposed to be in any boardroom.
Yeah, this is May 12th.
This is crazy. I wonder if Oprah was being held at gunpoint when she did that intro. But here it is.
In this particular room, there's a wealth of things that I cannot live without, starting with the backgammon table. This is actually sort of game central over here. I have Monopoly, I have Cranium.
Pause it. Hold on. Can we go back to that backgammon table? Look at that. That's weird. They just look at it. It's like we casually put the cards right there. Where do they play the cards? Where do they put that table? I don't buy any of it. I don't think anybody's ever played that game. There's no way. I doubt it. Where's the other die? Why is there only one die there? No. Forget it. She could totally live without that, but I want to seem human. Go ahead.
This is actually sort of game central over here.
Yeah, it's game central.
I have Monopoly, I have Cranium, I have Clue. Well, I'm very competitive.
Whoa. That Clue is still in the box. Still in the box. It's such a lie. So is it the Monopoly. They all are. They're all the Twisters also in the box.
They've got the packaging on.
They're all still shrink-wrapped. They bought it for this. They bought it for this. We got all the games here. Look at, I purchased them. We just had... Now, hold on for 1 second. Can we also just throw some books up there so it doesn't look like it's too done? I mean, this is so freaking manufactured. Every single one of those games is still in the shrink wrap. Continue.
Clue. Well, I'm very competitive. Mm. So even these, you know, silly childhood games, I take rather seriously.
Pause it.
Monkeys.
You know what? I take them so seriously, I don't even take them out of the box. I'm so competitive, I don't want them worn out in any fashion.
You collect them and sell them 20 years later.
Yeah, here we go.
Rather seriously. Monkeys, somehow, I've found that I have quite a fascination with. I have all these simian things all over my apartment. Mm. I love this drunk monkey. I carted a garbage can back from somewhere in the south of France as a carry-on, and I'm very happy I did it.
Pause it. I will be willing to wager anything that she did not cart that back.
And I caught it. In.
I like how it's like, you can see my whole apartment, but let's just stay in this one room.
Photo albums, and then, of course, photos. Very important. I think they were probably the one thing I couldn't live without. I have a bunch of these all over my apartment, so they're a lot of fun, good memories. Digital recorder.
Digital video recorder.
Now I can actually watch the television that I want to watch.
Pause it. Well, yeah, we just got this DVR thing. It's really great. You know what I noticed about this? And look, I'm not going to be in a position to judge. I don't want to judge because I can't stand my kids. But all the important things in her life are all in this like tiny, tiny room. She lives at like 4 floors of a New York City apartment. It's all in this tiny, tiny room, and none of them have to do with the children. This is just the important thing that I look at. My box of games, like, because the games up there imply like she plays them with the children, right? Of course, they're not even open. Oh my God. You know, Oprah, I feel like Oprah should, I want to hear the apology from Oprah for that segment. Are you kidding me?
Oprah is currently embroiled in a very recent scandal.
Really?
Yes, because she put up a photo of herself with a woman who was pushing her dog in a stroller, as we all know is incredibly normal around here, and called it, like, for Mother's Day. It's like your pet, you're a mother of a pet, and people are like, wow, that's not being a mother.
Oh, my God.
It's really a firestorm.
Yes, that's not being a mother. How dare you, Oprah? But I like the piece where you had, where you pretended like Ivanka Trump was a human being and allowed her to show off her still in the packages games.
What do you think shooting that was like from like the behind the scenes standpoint? Because they obviously let like a camera guy in the room.
The camera guy, that camera guy should be given a medal. Because that camera guy definitely said, no, the wrapping won't show up. The lighting is such an idiot. You won't see it.
Don't worry about it.
Let's just shoot. It's great. It's great. No, it looks really good. And it really does make you look like you're having fun and with kids things. You're a little bit
frivolous. It
looks frivolous.
Like you're doing exactly what you say you're doing.
I want to give that cameraman or woman, I want to give that camera person a freaking medal.
When I'm asked what I couldn't live without, the first thought I go to is the backgammon.
Oh, and this DVR, I finally have the ability to watch television. Can you imagine? Here I am, a billionaire, and we did not have television recording technology that has been available for over a decade. We didn't have it here yet. No, now I can finally watch television, Fox News.
It does remind me, though, obviously in her case it's ridiculous, but there was this really bizarre article that came out when Mitt Romney was running for president about how he was, like, other than I'm in, you know, the car elevator, obviously, but with, like, day-to-day consumer goods, he had, like, the spending habits of somebody on, like, a, you know, lower middle-class budget. And he would, like, brag about how, oh, I don't know apps that, you know, cost anything or on my iPad. And the whole point of the article, which was kind of great, was, like, he was essentially a walking contradiction of trickle-down economics, which is like basically like, yes, he has a lot of money, and he hoards it in this bizarre, obsessively cheap fashion, and then occasionally indulges in like hyper-extravagance, which has nothing to do with the rest of the economy. But like the day in and day out of like, I'll buy more cereal, I'll buy more apps. He's just like, oh, yeah, all the cereals, like, you know, Caldor brand cereal. And I get, like, detergent from, like, Sam's, like, living, like, almost on, like, a 40, you know, grand a year budget.
I'm sorry.
Funny.
I'm not convinced that it wasn't like, okay, are we done now? Can we go back to the way that we really live?
You know, I think it's he is so bizarre that I actually do find it plausible that he would have, like, private jet, car elevators, and then be like, everything else could be Sam's Club.
Here is, this also is very fun. I mean, you get the sense, I mean, this is why I like this clip so much, is because the veneer falls away from the show a little bit, where you realize, like, Alex Jones is literally sitting there going like, God damn it, this guy is really totally effing nuts. And he's not following the goddamn script. So Alex Jones goes to throw to a video roll-in, and Cernovich, who doesn't seem capable of looking at Alex Jones, he doesn't seem capable of looking at another human being. Was this guy really, like, he sold books about pickup artistry?
Yes. He's like, here's how you get curls. You sit at the corner of a bar and look at yourself and then occasionally mutter something sexist in their general direction. You'll get laid all the fucking time.
So Cernovich doesn't pick up on the cue and starts to vamp, and just Alex Jones just looks at him like, what? We're supposed to.
But can I just say, watch for the hand movement here that Jones makes.
Okay.
And says, well, Trump's repealed DACA, horrible, racist, evil person. He's not welcome here. And by the way, if you're illegal, you're welcome here. All Trump said is, these aren't really kids that were already here since they were little. It's mainly adults and people that have been deported before, and it's all fake, and there's got to be some vetting. This is an executive order outside of law, just legalizing everybody. But then that was ignored.
Hold on. I mean, just that obviously is just a huge steaming sack of lies. These people are generally older, but they were brought here as children. That's the point. They've been here in some instances for 20, 25 years, living as Americans, in many cases, for the first 10 years probably they were here, assuming they were, because they just didn't know they didn't have paperwork. But that's not the point of this.
But then that was ignored what he really said. But think about the takeaway of this with this mayor, where you can say, okay, and also not welcome, law and order, also not welcome, safe society, also not welcome, a property tax base that isn't being eroded. I mean, these Democrat-run cities are sinking into the mud. And here is Rahm Emanuel demonizing the president, trying to save the economy.
Right, because he has no answers. He has no answer for the violence. He has no leadership. While there, how many people are shot every weekend in Chicago? 30 to 50 people some weekends are shot. Record numbers of murders in Chicago. And rather than deal with those real problems, he virtue signals, which is all, this is why Hillary lost. This is why the Democrats keep losing.
By the way, do we not have that clip? Because there's a press conference.
Could you shut up?
Oh, it's ready. Okay, well, let's go ahead and play that clip.
Roger Stone's friend, could you please shut your mouth? Let's just go to the clip.
Did you see what he did with his fist?
When he goes like that.
It's almost like I wish that could be like a visual drop that we could use. He literally ended after. He's like, yeah, okay, great. That was brilliant. I think we have that clip ready that you just fucked up. It actually was ready about a minute ago.
He doesn't even say that. He's like, shut the hell up. All right, we have a clip. God damn it.
Oh, and then you see the, his face.
Can you imagine when they
Cernovich
cut? When
Cernovich starts talking. Yes! Is this not to me, there's more and more proof every day that Alex Jones is like more the charlatan than the madman.
Look, I may be a crazy lunatic, but I am still a goddamn businessman.
Trying to run a professional drug. What you do is you lie.
I may be out of my mind, but I still put my pants on one leg at a time.
You lie about DACA, and then you say that Rahm Emanuel's inviting drug cartels to set up in Chicago, and then you play the fucking sound.
Half the time, Roger Stone shows up in his bathrobe, and now I got to deal with his friends. All right, play this again. Play this, just this moment, right? Just play this moment again.
Eroded. I mean, these Democrat-run cities are sinking into the mud, and here is Rahm Emanuel demonizing the president, trying to save the economy.
Right, because he has no answers. He has no answer for the violence. He has no leadership. While there, how many people are shot every weekend in Chicago? 30 to 50 people some week.
Oh my God. And so goes the final appearance of Mike Cernovich on InfoWars. Unbelievable. Hi, folks. Sam Seder here. We still need your help on our Patreon page. YouTube ads have come back, but not nearly as much as we had before. So if you can help us out, any little bit helps. Head over to our Patreon page right at this URL, and you'll help us keep helping you by making videos.